Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the central Catskill region. Health Cetera in the Catskills is broadcast from the WIOX radio station in Roxbury, New York, which is the ancient and unceded territory of the Esopus clan of the Lenape people, also known as the Munsee, who are the first caretakers living with this land. Today, we live in the influence of what is now called the Lenape Nation of the northeastern woodlands in the United States and Canada. Their territory includes present-day northeastern Delaware, New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania, along the Delaware River watershed, New York City, western Long Island, and the lower Hudson Valley. Today on Health Cetera, I'm going to talk with Eileen Knott of the Western Catskills Community Revitalization Council about financial stress, particularly around housing and its impact on mental health. We'll also talk about the financial counseling service that she provides for free at Western Catskills. But first, I try to focus regularly on this program on mental and behavioral health because there's so much suffering from mental health problems and addictions in the United States and in our region. And in recognition of the impact of mental health problems on our communities, Delaware County has a mental health department and clinic. I'm pleased to have on the program today Doug Elston, a licensed social worker and the Delaware County Director of Community Service, which primarily oversees mental health and substance abuse services in the county. Prior to his appointment as director, he was a clinician for about 24 years, working primarily with children and families. Doug, welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I have to say to listeners that I had heard really good things about Doug, and then I had a chance to be with him in a meeting of some people who were concerned about mental health issues, and he certainly lived up to the reputation that he's earned. So I'm really pleased to have him here. So, Doug, we know that mental health issues go across all age groups, and they're nationwide, but we want to focus today on the state of mental health for adults and children in Delaware County. How are we doing, and how do we compare with the rest of the state and the nation?
Unfortunately, we have a lot of similarities as far as the need for mental health and substance abuse treatment. The COVID pandemic really brought to the forefront the need in this area. You know, since I've been director, one of the phrases that I've heard is, if you've seen one county, you've seen one county. Every county, every region, every state is different, has their own unique challenges as well as strengths. We certainly saw, as just about all providers have seen during the pandemic, an increase in referrals for outpatient treatment services. We weathered that storm fairly well in a sense that we have prescribers in-house, which is a real strength for our county. There's many counties in upstate New York that do not have in-house prescribers, so this is one of the strengths that we've had. Many counties, unfortunately, community-based mental health clinics, because of the large number of referrals, they've had to revert to wait lists. We really haven't had to do that much during the pandemic. There were two very brief periods of time, both less than a month, that we had a wait list. But that is cleared up now, and so we're open for business. We could see people just about daily during our open access approach.
So, Doug, do you know how we're doing on suicide rate? I met with the chair of the Board of Supervisors probably now a couple years ago, Tina Molay, and she had shared with me her deep concern about the suicide rate in the county. Do you have any data on how we're doing with that?
I don't have any current update data. I will say, Diana, unfortunately, the years that I've been here, I was aware that Delaware County has consistently and near the top as far as suicide rates per capita. You know, we in our county, we have less than 45,000 residents. So when it comes to statistics, they're usually based on increments of 100,000. But having said that, per Delaware County versus other counties, we have had a high rate of suicide. And unfortunately, many of those who have committed suicide, they were unknown to the clinic. They haven't been engaged for evaluation, assessment, or treatment. And I think that's one of the challenges that we have is the stigma associated with mental illness and substance abuse. And the state, as well as our county, are making efforts to reach out to the community at large to educate. For example, there are statistics that show that at any given time, a lot of Americans will meet the criteria for clinical depression. That doesn't mean that they need treatment, doesn't mean that they need medication, certainly doesn't mean that they'll be psychiatrically hospitalized, but there is a strong correlation between clinical depression and suicide.
Now, you mentioned that one of the reasons for sort of this uptick in mental health problems was the isolation in COVID. And I want to talk about some other factors that may be at play in our county. And I'm glad you mentioned stigma, because I do think that is a strong one, that people really are reluctant to say they're struggling from a mental health perspective and to seek support. It also seems to me that another factor, we are such a rural county, that isolation, I would think, would play a role in this, particularly with such a large farming community. You can really become quite isolated on some of these farms. Is that a factor in our county?
Yes, it is. And the pandemic really exacerbated that. You know, during the lockdown, people weren't leaving their homes. They weren't going out into the community and interacting with neighbors like they did prior. So, yes, that social isolation just contributes and worsens symptoms of depression and anxiety. So that definitely is a factor, social isolation.
And I want to ask you about an article that I just read today. I want to say it was in the New York Times, but it could have been elsewhere, about a school that had children, the students in the school, lock in their cell phones, that there is a company that now makes these pockets that you put your cell phone in. It locks it until the school hour ends or the school day ends. And there was a lot of concern about the students were really upset initially, et cetera. But that now, as this has become habit, it takes the burden off the teachers of restricting cell phone use. And the children are saying that it's much better for them. They can pay attention more. They're not having to think about their phones and, oh, I should check in on my phone. What's your sense about the role that our social media and cell phones are playing in all of this?
I also think they contribute to the isolation as well as to symptoms of various mental illness. There's a disconnect with having personal face-to-face interactions with classmates, neighbors, friends, families, etc. And I think part of that is related to social media and availability of cell phones, especially for young people. You go out in public, you go in a restaurant, you know, and I've done this myself. You're sitting there with family and you look around and everyone's on their cell phone, but you're all sitting together. That definitely, in my view, is a factor that's contributing to the difficulties.
Are there any other factors that we haven't talked about that you think we should?
You know, transportation is a major issue for us. Unfortunately, we do have low-income population that has to rely on Medicaid transportation, and they, unfortunately, aren't always reliable. You know, we here in the Catskill Mountains, we have winter weather, so that sometimes could interfere. So transportation is a significant factor, and we're looking at ways. I know this is something not just with our clinic, but a lot of the county agencies, I know the Board of Supervisors has taken a look at that to see what we could do to improve the quality of life and transportation issues for our residents.
Somebody recently said to me that 1 in 10 people in the country has no access to transportation. I'm not sure if that's accurate. The other issue then in keeping with that probably is our issues with broadband access.
Internet connectivity is an issue. When the pandemic first started, you know, prior to the pandemic, virtual or telehealth services were really unheard of. Mm-hmm. But with the pandemic, that really was put out there at the forefront. And many counties, including us, we have that availability. The challenge that we found here clinically was that if a person is in their home and they don't have a good connection to their Wi-Fi, you lose contact with them. Yeah. Also, downloading some of the programs so you can engage in the virtual connection, that could be a challenge for people who aren't very computer savvy. So those are issues, too.
So tell us about the Delaware County Mental Health Clinic and what you provide there.
We provide individual evaluation and assessment, treatment, medication evaluation, and prescribing. We work with children and families. We have our single point of access program, SPOA, and that is a program for individuals who need more than just verbal therapy and medication. This would be services such as case management services and housing for the serious and persistent mentally ill. We do provide some jail-based services. We do have supporting housing services, again, for those with serious mental illness.
Wow. So the supportive housing, how has that happened? Who pays for the housing?
The housing is a state-funded program. So we currently are seeing approximately 40 people. There's 40 individuals who are receiving this benefit, state-funded. And our supportive housing case manager, what he can do is he could help a person find an apartment, maybe pay security deposit, help furnish the home with furniture, bedding if needed. The challenge there is where everywhere else, it seems, is housing availability. There's not a lot of housing available. And unfortunately, this contributes to homelessness, especially those with serious persistent mental illness, those with substance abuse. And this is one of the factors that unfortunately is contributing to our county's homeless population. Yes. That I know the Department of Social Services is addressing.
So do you follow people when they're homeless? Are you able to do that?
Yes, it could be challenging at times, especially if they're not really engaged in treatment. Yeah. You know, part of it's the stigma, part of it's trust issues, part of it's logistics and getting here. We work closely with Rehabilitative Support Services here in Walton, and they provide some outstanding case managers who have the ability to go out in the field and begin to connect with these individuals. And over time, they develop that relationship. They built this positive, trusting relationship, and they've been really successful being able to get people to come in and stay engaged in treatment and then begin to connect with the county service providers to include the supportive housing program.
Great. So we should point out that the clinic itself is in Walton, right?
Yes, ma'am.
In this new building, we just knew, 2 years ago?
Yes, we moved into this new facility in November of 2021. Prior to that, the children's clinic, the substance abuse clinic, and the adult clinic were in three different locations. And that created challenges both for clinical staff as well as our clients, especially if they had, for example, an appointment at the children's clinic, but they needed to see the prescriber that day. They would have to leave one building, drive across town to get to the adult clinic, and of course traffic and things like that often contribute to the logistical difficulties there. It was an area of lost revenue for us, so the county built a brand new building, and now we house all three programs. We have the substance abuse program, children's mental health, and adult mental health all in the same building.
And just to be clear, these are day services. They're not overnight, or can you provide an overnight service if somebody needs it?
Yeah, we are an outpatient clinic that provides services during the day. our operating hours, Monday and Friday are 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, 8 to 6. And we could expand as needed. If people would like a later appointment, we would try to facilitate that.
And so who are you targeting here? If I feel like I'm anxious, I need some talk therapy, I need to figure this out, am I contacting you for that service? Or are you looking, my understanding was that you were really trying to prioritize serving people who have more chronic, persistent, and serious mental illnesses. But clarify this for me.
Yeah, one of the I'd say the number one challenge for providers, definitely in New York City, New York State, and throughout the country, is workforce issues. Mm-hmm. So there have been a few times where we might refer a person out to a private practitioner, especially if their needs weren't very significant. And I don't mean to diminish someone struggling, but for example, if someone was psychiatrically hospitalized due to suicidal ideation, they would kind of take precedent for that. So we are pretty close to being fully staffed, which we haven't been fully staffed since 2017, even before the pandemic. So this is one of the challenges, again, not only for our county, but for the state as a whole.
That's really good to hear that you're fully staffed, because workforce issues are so huge, and particularly around mental health issues. So on your website, you list the different services that are provided than therapies, whether it's family therapy, individual therapy. And I was intrigued by a couple that I didn't know much about. One was eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. What is that?
EMDR. It's been around since the mid to late 90s. It was developed by a Dr. Francine Shapiro. And in our field, kind of the bread and butter treatment approach is cognitive behavior therapies, mm-hmm. which really help a person with, for example, anxiety and depression to become aware and evaluate their thoughts, mm-hmm. their beliefs, and if they're inaccurate, learning how to begin to modify those that then would lead to a decreased intensity of emotions. That were problematic. Clinicians in our field have found over the last couple of decades that approach, even though it's very strongly evidence-based, there are many people who still struggle and suffer from the mental health symptoms, especially associated with anxiety and trauma. And the theory is that as our body floods with stress chemicals, cortisol, adrenaline, that those images, those memories, those thoughts, they kind of get wired into parts of the brain that then interfere with processing. So that even though the person may have the ability and is demonstrating being able to modify negative thinking patterns, when you have a strong physiological reaction to triggers, that cognitive aspect of the work may not be enough to really begin to alter the process and improve functioning. So Francine Shapiro, my understanding is that she was experiencing some emotional distress, and she went for a walk. I think it was in Central Park, and as she's walking through the park, she's looking out in front of her, and she's gazing back and forth, her eyesight, and she begins to notice alleviation of her anxiety symptoms. So she started looking into it more, and it's really blossomed into a recognized evidence-based approach to treating people with trauma disorders.
So what, you have them go out and walk in the woods?
Not necessarily. No, it's a strategy, and you know, there's a process to it. Okay. You don't start this process at the beginning of therapy. There's a lot of things that has to build up first. But what happens is when the person is ready, they begin to kind of relive the traumatic experience, and they don't necessarily have to be verbal and talk about it. They could just imagine and recollect in their memory. And as they're doing that, it's a mind-body therapy approach that you connect the physiology of what's going on in the body with the memories. And one way to do that is through this bilateral eye movement back and forth. And the theory is being able to have that bilateral physiological experience, that somehow improves the processing ability in the brain to then regulate emotions and begin to kind of overprint that traumatic experience, so that people then, it's not like they will completely forget about the traumatic experience, they can actually talk about it, and they won't experience the intense emotional reaction that they might prior to the treatment. Mind-body therapies are really coming to the forefront, especially with trauma-informed treatment and care. Others trauma-informed practices include like somatic experiencing. That's another one that's very powerful. Drama therapy. There's a couple of them. We do have clinicians here at our clinic who've been trained in accelerated resolution therapy. That's a brief form of EMDR. And years ago, prior to the pandemic, we had quite a few clinicians who were trained in EMDR, and unfortunately, they moved on. Some of them went to other agencies. Some of them went into private practice. We did have, just recently, one of our clinicians complete a course in EMDR training. So that's a service that we'll be able to provide.
Good, good. Well, it's fascinating. So I do want to take a few minutes to talk about what you were talking about in this meeting that I referred to, and your vision for really helping to foster mental health in communities. This is not just about treatment in a clinic. It really is about promoting mental health in communities beyond that clinic. So tell us a little bit about what your vision is for this work that you're undertaking.
Specifically related to my experience working as a children and families clinician for many, many years. I was formally trained in graduate school in behavioral approaches and cognitive behavioral therapy, which they have their place in time. They are effective. They are evidence-based. But as I become more experienced early on in my professional development, I found that there were many children, many families who are struggling with symptoms that the behavioral approach just wasn't working. In fact, sometimes the parents would come back and report things are getting worse, my kids becoming explosive. So I read this book called The Explosive Child. I was exposed to that as an undergraduate, written by Dr. Ross Green. And I highly recommend his work. It's exceptional. And he talks about really helping children, understanding that children don't like to get into trouble. They don't like having to face negative consequences. He has this mantra that's wonderful: children do well if they can. And so what his approach does is it encourages the adult who interacts with the child. That could be any adult. It could be the parent, the teacher, the bus driver, the lady in the cafeteria. Anyone who interacts with children can learn this approach. It's a way of engaging the youngster and conveying empathy in a warm, curious manner. And it really goes to begin to assess and develop what that youngster's lagging thinking skills are. Similarly to, you know, when we teach math, for example, in school, the teachers don't provide 1 hour instruction on how to do multiplication. It's an ongoing process. So this approach is the same in the sense that it's a relationship, and it's eliciting from the youngster what they're experiencing, what are they thinking, what are they feeling. And what I found clinically is that a lot of youngsters, their ability to think really was lagging in a sense. They didn't know what more to do. So that they would then revert back to problematic behaviors that resulted in more negative consequences for them.
So you're working with schools around this, right?
Yes, part of, we get Delaware County's in receipt of opiate settlement funds, And we were able to allocate some of those funds as a prevention measure here for the schools. And it's a work in progress. We've got approval to train and certify 8 educators in our county in this approach. And what's really fabulous is once these educators become certified, and it's a process, but once they become certified, not only will they be able to engage students in their classrooms, but they will be able to go to other schools in the area to train their staff as well.
And what about working with parents on this?
Clinically, I would include parents. It's not necessarily something you do with a child or a student alone. My therapeutic orientation is you always want to include parents. There are sometimes exceptions to that, but generally you want to include parents. Kids often laugh when I tell them that, you know, part of my job is to help you get to a place where you can fire me, where you don't need me anymore. And part of that is going to be having your parents help identify and teach lagging thinking skills. And what's powerful about this is it's a conversation. And each time the adult has this conversation with the kid, the kid's thinking gets sharper and sharper and sharper. A good example is over the years, you know, I will explore emotions with kids. And most kids readily identify mad, angry, sad. But they really struggle really identifying and labeling more complex emotional states. And that's part of the difficulty is if they don't have the ability to do that, they're going to struggle more in recognizing that emotional state in other people. They're going to have difficulty regulating the emotion, and they're going to have difficulty problem solving what's going on that leads to that emotional state. So what's really powerful is each time the youngster goes through this warm, curious process, you can see their thinking gets better and better and better. And after a number of trials, a number of conversations doing this, the youngster is sharp. They're immediately able to identify solutions. They're able to identify the pros and cons to the solution. And what's really powerful, it's not the therapist or the adult telling the student, this is what you do and this is the consequences. It's really leading them to think that through and come up with those conclusions on their own, which is more empowering for them. And they're going to be much more likely to now engage in that pro-social activity, that coping mechanism, that task that parents or teachers will expect of them. They're much more likely to do it on their own because they're thinking about the pros to that. What else is really neat about this approach is once that young person experiences the success of applying this model in one area, they start to generalize it in other areas, and they just grow. And it's a really wonderful approach, so I'm really proud that we're going to be able to bring this to students, not only Delaware County, but some of the surrounding counties as well.
That's fabulous. It's really exciting, and I love that it's looking at prevention, I'll look forward to hearing how it's going. So we're about out of time. I want to make sure that people know how to contact the Delaware County Mental Health Clinic. How can they get more information on it? And if they want to explore getting an appointment, how would they do that?
Sure. You can go to the Delaware County website. We are under the Mental Health Department. You can also find us on Facebook. So those two places will have our telephone number and contact information.
Okay. And how long does it take to get an appointment?
Right now, we're operating what's called open access. If someone calls today and they want to get in today, we are going to likely see them today.
That is awesome. That is fabulous news. Doug Elston, you are a breath of fresh air. I want to thank you so much for coming on to Health Center and the Catskills, and I want you to commit to coming back on and talking about these issues some more. There's so much more we could talk about, and I think it's so important that the community understand in a little bit more depth how do we prevent mental health problems, and once if they're occurring, what are the options for dealing with them? So My thanks to you, Doug Alston, who is the social worker, a licensed social worker, and Delaware County Director of Community Service, who oversees the mental health and substance abuse services of the county. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you, Diana.
Bye. Really good stuff. I'm very impressed with what he's doing, and that last news that you can get seen the same day is really, really exciting and so important. Well, my thanks to Doug Elston. I'm Diana Mason. You're listening to Health Center in the Catskills.